Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer, Alan Shartok, and Roundtable host Joe Donahue were joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week, giving you a chance to catch up, ponder, or reconsider. On Monday, December 7th, Alan and Joe welcomed political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies Jennifer Burns, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson.
We've been talking about the fact that the president spent a good deal of Saturday continuing the rant that he released on video last week, and basically, as the Washington Post put it, regurgitating a litany of baseless accusations of election fraud. So now he is continues the fight and continues not to be doing anything else other than apparently stewing about the election. So the Washington Post reports, even as Trump has been consumed with his waning political fortunes in a desperate attempt to retain power, his administration has accelerated efforts to lock in last-minute policy gains and staffing assignments that it hopes will help cement the president's legacy and live on past January 20th, when President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in. For example, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services adopted a longer and more difficult citizenship test that critics said could further curb legal immigration. The Pentagon named 11 new members, including a pair of prominent former Trump campaign aides, to a Defense Department Business Advisory Board. And the president signed an executive order drafted by the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy aimed at protecting civil liberties and the use of artificial intelligence by the federal government. So you look ahead at the final 6 weeks of Trump's presidency, the administration has no plans to wind down its efforts to remake federal policies and even the government bureaucracy itself, according to aides. Despite the pending handoff to the incoming Democratic administration, the whirlwind of activities has bucked tradition of past presidents who have deferred on major policy actions during the lame duck period. And in some cases, the moves could make it procedurally or politically challenging for Biden to fulfill campaign pledges to unwind the Trump team's actions. Alan, I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about just this lame duck period and traditionally what it has been and why this, what we're seeing is somewhat unusual.
Well, we do know that Trump had, 72 million people voting for him. And I've been trying to figure out what's on his mind. I can't, to be honest. His approach is so crazy, nuts, meshuggah, that I can't figure out what kind of a human being would have this lack of responsibility and, frankly, patriotism towards the country. I can't figure it out. But if I had to take a guess, it would be that in order to keep that 70 million or 72 million intact, he has to continue to act the way that he is now and to rail against the others. And at the same time, he has to keep his major contributors happy. And that's what he's doing with all of this nonsense. He'll do whatever he can to mess up the ship of state. And he will continue to do that because clearly that is where he thinks his political advantages lie.
Libby?
So my question is this. He's doing most of this by regulation and executive order. I mean, nothing legislative is being done because the House wouldn't pass anything. How much of this can Biden simply overturn with his own set of regulations and executive orders? I understand if they do the oil leases between now and January 20th, they may be hard to break if there's actually ink on paper and a signature. But what about the other things that he's doing, like the immigration stuff, like the citizenship test? I mean, aren't these things that he's done by executive fiat, can't they be overturned by a new president?
Yes. And in fact, Biden has already said he's going to.
Right. He's going to have a stack of executive orders on his desk that will probably be taller than he is when he's standing up because of everything so heinous that Trump has done. So, you know, I understand why I understand the legacy issue for Trump, but I don't think it's going to be there when push comes to shove. I think Biden will overturn almost everything that he's done.
But it is being made harder. I mean, they're doing this to make it harder and
sure.
for it to take more time.
He's doing it to waste time, to build his own base in terms of, look what those horrible Democrats are doing. You see, they really hate Americans. But there were 80 million Americans who voted for Joe Biden. And there are many, many more coming on to the election rolls as kids get older. And groups like Stacey Abrams doing a great job in registering people to vote, that I think the voice of America will be one of, diversity, plurality, and inclusion, rather than this very narrow scope of who is really an American, which is white men, basically.
So two steps
forward. Angry white men.
Two steps forward, two steps back, two steps forward, two steps back. So, Sarah, it seems like we have seen in the last 4 years the Trump administration do everything it can, both in legislation as well as executive order, to turn back the Obama legacy. Now it'll be up to, in with seeing what we're talking about right now, is Biden returning things to either the way they were or to improve in some way, shape, or form? Does it always have to be this way of, instead of moving forward, you just... two steps forward, two steps back?
It's really aggravating, for sure. And we actually hear from the incoming administration a little bit of waffling around, it's going to be tough. There's a lot that he did in immigration. It's going to be a lot to undo. It's an opportunity. You know, it's not like Trump took measurable, measured steps when he came in office. One of the first things he did was try to eliminate DACA, just eliminate it straight up. And, you know, it's what this signals is that the long-term battle ahead, the battle for the soul of this country, which we thought we're sort of fighting in November, it's not going to be over for a very, very long time. One of the questions that they changed, one of the more controversial questions that they changed on the citizenship test is, who does a U.S. senator represent? And the correct answer used to be all people of the state. On the new test, it's citizens in the state, right? That's a normative claim. That's saying immigrants, you're not welcome. You know, who is a citizen? Who is a person, right? That's the Roe versus Wade challenge. What does it mean? What is basic things that we thought that we had a shared understanding of? Those are the normative erosions that he's doing, that he's done his whole presidency and is going to be doing in the days leading up. So I think it's less about, two steps forward, two steps back. It's like 8,000 steps back.
Yes.
And now what?
You're right. I want to get to Jennifer on this particular topic and then come back to you, because over the weekend, the judge ordered that the government fully reinstate DACA, and I would like to talk to you about that. But Jennifer, in this overall issue of the changes and what can be undone and what can be redone, your thoughts on that?
I think some of it can be redone, but I do agree with Libby and Sarah on this, in the sense that it is it's a time suck. It's requiring people that are going to be in these positions under Biden to spend incredible amounts of time on kind of dismantling or correcting, rather than looking forward, unless if they can do both, really address what Trump administration has put into place, but also do it in a way that's very forward thinking, that protects it for many years. The other thing I think that's important here is to look at that Senate and keep watching it in Georgia, because we have to remember that the Republicans in Georgia that Trump is attacking, right, are going to definitely have to figure out what to do with their party in the GOP. And Governor Kemp is going to be up for election in 2020, or re-election, or running for election, right? So when this happens, Georgia is going to shift depending on if Loeffler wins or if Purdue wins. And we have to think futuristically about how Biden's team is going to try to address what Trump's putting into place, but also how the Senate might change or might not just in this election, but as the governors and local officials in Georgia in the next 4 years might change.
There was major action over the weekend, a judge ordering the government to fully reinstate the DACA program. Up to 300,000 additional undocumented immigrants could be allowed to apply for protection from deportation under the new court ruling. President Trump had sought to cancel the program. The federal judge on Friday ordered the Trump administration to fully restore the Obama-era program designed to shield young undocumented immigrants from deportation, dealing what could be a final blow to President Trump's long-fought effort to end the protections. Sarah, as promised, let me go to you on this and say, do you look at this as a final blow?
Yes and no. There are lots of ways that the Trump administration can still try to interfere with DACA. It's possible that this can go, that the DACA fight can go back up to the Supreme Court. Sorry, my dog. and that would be a different court because, of course, instead of Ginsburg, we have Amy Coney Barrett, and Amy Coney Barrett has signaled in the past restrictionist views about immigrants. And I give up trying to predict what will happen as long as he has any power whatsoever. But what I will say is that it's extraordinary. We've been operating under a very limited DACA program for a very long time, and this reinstates it for new applicants, not just so you'll remember the prior reinstatement was a partial reinstatement because the Supreme Court basically told the Trump administration that they rescinded it incorrectly, that they didn't follow the rules when they rescinded it. This particular ruling is different. It says that the person that Chad Wolf acted outside of his scope of authority in his memo. So the memo is invalid, which reinstates the program, which means that new applicants can apply, which has been frozen for a long time. First, it was that no one could apply. Then it was that you can only submit renewals and that they would only be valid for a shortened period of time. And now it's completely restored back to its original, well, not its original, right? The Supreme Court or the Fifth Circuit struck down another part of this back under the Obama administration. But long story short, there's still a chance for Trump to mess with DACA. And that's why it's a really problematic the Obama administration, rather than continuing to push on Congress and the various gangs of however many numbers to really make lasting change in immigration law and policy, that they settled for executive action. Because this is what happens. And this is the two steps forward, two steps back in immigration, that it just enrages every practicing immigration lawyer and professor in the country, because if every 5 days something changes, and under this administration, it's way more often than that. And so, you know, I'm not going to predict what happens next, but I will tell you that there's a groundswell of support for whatever happens next in support of DACA, because this, you'll remember, was a grassroots movement of young people, of undocumented folks themselves, and they're not giving up anytime soon.
Can you address the timing of the decision from the court? I assume that is on purpose. You don't do it before the election, you do it after, you do it on a Friday, you do it. I don't know. Am I making that up, or is there a plan there?
You mean the timing of the decision from the more recent decision from the court?
Yes, this latest decision.
So I haven't looked at the docketing, and I haven't seen anybody write up an analysis of that. It may be that the case just, you know, was kicking around so long that that their internal deadlines were triggered in terms of when I haven't seen a court time a ruling around political considerations. I'll just say it that way.
Okay. Well, that was my question, so that answers that. Okay.
Well, you know, we have how many days to go before the inauguration? Something like 40-something, is that right?
40, yep.
So, you know, ordinarily you would think that a lower court decision would end up in the Supreme Court if they thought that they were right, especially with this court. In other words, if it's a lower court decision, sooner or later the Trump people would appeal it to the Supreme Court where they will have, you know, a better ear. Just adds to the legend of Trump as a stinker, you know, that he would sink all these deserving, wonderful young people, many of whom haven't been in another country ever, or if they have, it was at birth, and now you know, his attempts to take it out on them and by getting them back there, it's just and depriving them of any kind of resources.
It's really a challenge for the Biden administration still, too, though, right? Like the court, it's not like Trump leaves office and this lawsuit disappears, right? They can still, the government can still appeal. And so, like, it's a challenge for the Biden administration because of all the rulings that have issued so far, right? He's bound by the same rulings in terms of how to administratively change the DACA program in any way, right? He's bound by the same Supreme Court opinion. He's also bound by the opinion that restricts, you know, sort of puts constrictions around Chad Wolf's authority, right? Anybody, that means Chad's successor is bound by the same problem. So I read a Vox article that had an interesting analysis of, like, you know, if the Republicans retain control of the Senate and Biden's appointments are all tied up and remain acting secretaries of whatever, right? Because they haven't finished going through the process, if the Republicans are otherwise obstruct, right, appointments, then the Biden administration arguably, because of some of these rulings, may be sort of tied up in terms of what they can do. So they're trying to impact the Biden administration before it even gets off the ground.
But on the other hand, you don't really think that Joe Biden is going to adopt this nasty approach to
But what if he wanted to improve it, say, right? So he would be bound by the same issue. So it really speaks to why Congress needs to act. It's Congress who's in charge of immigration. Congress writes the Immigration and Nationality Act. Congress can amend it. And so, again, you know, it speaks to the importance of this Georgia election. We need not just comprehensive immigration reform. We need bold, progressive immigration overhaul, period.
Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Monday, December 7th. This is Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back to Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. On December 9th, Alan Shartok and Joe Donahue caught up with Wednesday regulars, investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, Times Union columnist Chris Churchill, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin.
So let's go to a very interesting story, I think. It was one that was not a big surprise, but we've sort of talked about it a lot on the show as a possibility. And yesterday, the Supreme Court made it clear they denied the allies of President Trump and their bid to overturn election results, in this case, in the state of Pennsylvania. The Supreme Court on Tuesday denied the last-minute attempt by President Trump's allies to overturn the election results in Pennsylvania, a blow to the president's continuing efforts to reverse his loss to Democrat Joe Biden. The court's brief order denying a requested injunction provided no reasoning, nor did it note any dissenting votes. It was the first request to delay or overturn the results of last month's presidential election to reach the court, and it appears that Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Trump's latest nominee, took part in the case. The lawsuit was part of a blizzard of litigation, and personal interventions that Trump and his lawyers have waged to overturn victories by Biden in a handful of key states. Alan, you've been worried about this for a long time. Are you feeling
Every
any
day.
Better?
No, no. I don't know what this guy is up to, and I know one thing. Whatever it is, whether it's the idea of criminal activity that he might be held accountable for, or civil activity that he might be held accountable for, he's going to be desperate until the last moment, and he's going to be pulling all of this nonsense, which is the greatest threat that I have seen in my life to American democracy, the peaceful transference of power. It's just awful. Well, in any case, I've got a little bit of concern about the Supreme Court, too. As we all know, the American government is divided up into the three branches, the Congress, the President, and the Supreme Court. And when they put out an order, and we don't know who voted how or what the various roles were, it's terrible. I mean, we need to know that. And as far as I'm concerned, this is a despicable action on their part, not to say that they were united or not united, so that we as citizens have some sense as to where all of this is going and how much danger we have.
Chris Churchill.
Well, I don't think it was despicable. I mean, it was just a brief order saying we're not going to hear your case. They do that all the time. This was a long shot. I don't think too many people who follow the court very closely thought they were going to accept this case. It was kind of the expected thing. This was a case that involved a Pennsylvania law and whether it met the requirements of the Pennsylvania state constitution. That is not something the U.S. Supreme Court would really ever have any sort of role in deciding. And it just was never going to go anywhere. So I don't think the court exactly needed to say that, give any sort of explanation or give any sort of breakdown of the vote. And, you know, the more important thing is that, as I said, yesterday was Safe Harbor Day, which means the electoral college slates are pretty much locked into place. And the president is really running out of legal options at this point.
Right of reply, Joe?
Yeah, of course, yes.
Many of his supporters seem to think. But
right of reply.
Right of reply. With all due respect, you know that, Chris. Nobody has more respect for you than I do.
You feel that respect every moment of the day, don't you, Chris?
Yeah, the respect just shines through the phone.
It oozes. Yes.
But I do think that we need to know in this particular case. You're right. Under ordinary circumstances, it would just be a brief order. But in this case, this president of the United States has appointed people into the court. We need to know where they are. We need to know how close this whole thing is. We need to know what kind of dissonance or lack of dissonance there is on the court. We'd love to know what John Roberts' role in all of this. I can only guess, that he's leader here. So I do think it's important that the more transparency, the better. And the court is coming around. I've always been one who thought that Supreme Court sessions should be on the air the moment they're on. Let everybody understand. I mean, if you can sit in the courtroom, why shouldn't you be able to watch it at home? Anyway, that's a long story, and I'm sure we'll return to it. And again, with great respect for you.
Bob.
Well, go ahead.
No, right of reply, Chris.
I think that if a few of the justices vigorously dissented, we would know about it, right? They would have written some, you know, I realize this is comparing apples to oranges, but we had a case involving churches in New York State a few weeks ago and you had, you know, seven different opinions written or something like that. You know, every justice wanted to weigh in to give their take. And then this, when nobody says peep, I think we can probably assume that nobody really thought this case was warranted for the court.
Write a reply. Bob
and Rosemary, we're never going to get to you, but go ahead.
With great respect, Chris, and to you, Rosemary, I can only say, we should really know what these people are doing. And I think you can't have a transparent democracy without that. Anyway, okay, over to whoever goes next.
Yes, Bob, go ahead.
So a couple points. And before anybody sends letters in, we do recognize that Pennsylvania is a commonwealth and not a state.
Yes.
So please don't flood
our
box.
Yes, we do.
And anytime we start a statement, with all due respect, typically there isn't any, but I will just note that that was very mature back and forth between Alan and Chris. You know,
civil,
I
respectful.
Actually,
yes.
Yes.
Chris is much taller and younger than I am. I know where to go.
Mm. You know, I read the one sentence denial, and the one thing that did jump out at me was that there was no dissent noted. And you know, Alan, I don't disagree with you. I think the Supreme Court should be televised. I'm somebody who watches C-SPAN and gets great pleasure in even prime minister questions. I would love to watch the public proceedings of the Supreme Court. And I think any time that government can be more transparent, it's better for all of us. You know, the ruling, though, sort of builds off of the unanimous ruling from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And we're getting to the point of really frivolous lawsuits. And, you know, one point that was made last week by one of the letter writers, which is spot on, was that, you know, the taxpayers are having to defend the state and local governments from this flood of absolutely ridiculous lawsuits that are only designed to curry favor with Trump and his minions. And at some point, I think we really do need to look at going back and seeing if we can recoup some of that money. If I could toss another twist into this, you know, I think it was also disgusting what the attorney general from Texas did, Paxton, filing a complaint against Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Georgia. I mean, this is just grandstanding and using public taxpayers to do it, and really is unacceptable when we have so many other issues that we should be focusing on.
I'm a little bit frustrated because, for one thing, the court has never, ever issued a vote or dissents on cert. That's what this was, whether to take a case or not. The court has always not just given one ruling saying we take it or not, and it's because the entire court is speaking. It's like in a newspaper when you don't sign the editorial. It's because this is what the newspaper stands for. That's what the court stands for. The case that Chris is citing was an actual case, and in those cases, then dissents and votes are very important to know about, but not whether or not they're taking a case or not. That has always been something of a mystery. It's part of what keeps the court. You don't know if they're going to take it or not, and it's very difficult to get a case taken. This one from Texas, it's not going to go anywhere either. This case was never going to go anywhere. There have been more than 50 cases brought by Trump and his allies, his campaign allies across the country. Every one of them has been thrown out, to the point, not just thrown out, but with words of ridicule and threats of disbarring the lawyers who brought the cases. So why would the Supreme Court, even people appointed by Trump, take on a case that is utterly without merit? And the same with the Texas one, which is just ridiculous on the face of it. The Supreme Court is set up from the earliest days decide on fights between the states. But this is Texas, the Attorney General of Texas, saying Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and two other states did it wrong. There's no conflict between them. There's absolutely nothing there that will let the court say, yes, we'll take this case. And I think it was never a threat. I think the word that Bob used, grandstanding, is exactly what this has been from the beginning. And Teresa had it right yesterday. It's all part of Trump's effort to raise $200 million. But it was never a serious legal threat. What I think we need to do moving forward is to take a look at the electoral system that is set up, because Trump, if he did nothing else, he certainly didn't really threaten it, but he pointed out every little weakness and flaw in the system. And we ought to be really nervous now about the role of legislatures in intervening in elections. It didn't happen this time, but we sure saw how it could have happened. And that's the lesson here.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only correction, though, Rosemary, is that occasionally they do actually submit dissent, like Sotomayor has done it on a couple of occasions, but it is very, very rare. But it can happen, but typically it is the black box that you described it.
With all due respect,
hardly though a despicable act. I can't think of any time they did it. You may be right. I'll go look that up. But it hardly is a despicable act. It is the normal, and it is exactly what Trump should have gotten: an anonymous rejection for a ridiculous action. I liked it.
Yeah. With all due respect to the fabulous Rosemary, I really don't agree with that. I think that this democracy was on the verge of this guy pulling a bloodless coup. And when it comes to something like that, and it comes to the public interest understanding what this court is doing and why they're doing it, I think we can say it's always been this way. But there are times, and I think this is one of them, when the court owes us more than that. So there's a real difference of opinion between Rosemary and Alan.
All right.
And Chris.
I think
we should be happy. I agree with Rosemary. I mean, I think the curtness of what they did says something. You know, I think if we had learned that it was 6-3 or 7-2 or something like that, I mean, it would have been, the window's open a little bit, or maybe some of these future cases have success.
That's right.
I think the way that they did it so curtly and just almost dismissively, like, you know, get that out of here.
Yep.
Like,
don't make us laugh. Yeah, that's how they did it. If we had known the exact vote, we'd be sitting here parsing it, saying, "Oh, it's because Amy Coney Barrett did so and so, or John
Roberts." What's wrong with that?
So-and-so. No, they rejected it because it's legally lacking.
I want to go to something that Alan said, you know, about the concern about violence. I mean, because I think we would be remiss if we don't raise what the Arizona Republican Party put out on social media.
A series of tweets was posted over the last 2 days by the Arizona Republican Party inciting violence and encouraging its supporters to give their lives in the effort to overturn the presidential results. The first tweet retweeted another user that said, "Stop the steal, which is a reference to the conservatives' theories that widespread voter fraud and election tampering handed Democratic President-elect Joe Biden the election. The user wrote, "I am willing to give my life for this fight." And then the state GOP retweeted that. Then the Republican Party in the state wrote, "He is, are you?" And then it sort of went downhill from there in another tweet. "This is what we do. This is who we are. Live for nothing or die for something." And then there is a photo with an arrow going pointed directly within an inch of a man's head. Bob.
So out of place in our society, and I usually don't feel like the Justice Department should be used in state matters, but in this situation, I really do think there needs to be investigation, and this is both inciting violence and acts to undermine our democracy, but it's also a sign of a really, you know, both how baseless and frankly evil some of the supporters of Trump in this absolutely discredited movement have become. The idea of falling back on violence, I mean, this has gone beyond from just being a sore loser to taking it to a whole new level. And frankly, it has no place in our society, and it should be investigated. And if folks are found guilty of violating any laws, they should be prosecuted.
I don't understand. I mean, this is obviously very serious, and I don't mean to be snarky, but so they're asking people to die over the fact that somebody else got more votes than their person did, right? I mean, is that that's ultimately what we're talking about?
If you take what they're saying seriously and literally, it, they're talking about the sedition and the country's, you know, the democracy being taken over by international forces, and you know, and I don't really want to give it any airtime, but
right.
I mean,
I understand.
So it, I'm not going to say that it makes sense in that context, but that's kind of the context that they're dealing in. And this rhetoric is fairly widespread, at least on, you know, on social media. And, you know, it is troubling. I mean, I hope that this was just some dumb intern with access to the Twitter account and doesn't really reflect anything more substantial than that. There are a lot of Republicans in Arizona who immediately denounced the tweets. But you know, it doesn't take much for some lunatic out there to start taking this stuff seriously and to do real damage. So I largely agree with Bob. It's troubling, and you know, and ultimately, you know, Trump is responsible for this. He's not doing anything to discourage this kind of talk. He seems to be encouraging it, if anything. And it's just I mean, there are a lot of Americans out there who still believe sincerely and firmly that this election is going to be overturned, and I'm not really sure what the reaction is going to be when it isn't, you know.
Rosemary?
Well, you know, it goes along with what he has done throughout his entire administration, encouraging division and violence, and supporting people who react to disagreements with violence. The Rittenhouse case just stands out in my mind. Here's a young, really troubled, stupid kid who takes a gun and kills people because he disagrees with their point of view on police brutality. So he kills over it, and he's been turned into something of a hero on the right, which is just so messed up, so deeply messed up. And this whole thing about a civil war brewing among the divisions that he has helped to foment and to encourage hits me personally. I have sons who are getting taking gun lessons and buying weapons, and it terrifies me and makes me very unhappy. It's one of the reasons I keep talking about doom. I think this is a really bad trend, and I don't see anything that's stopping it, anything that's countering it. I think Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have a huge problem on their hands to try to bring us back together, because we have not been this far apart since maybe the 60s.
Yeah, and if I could jump in, and at first I need to compliment you on the sound effects, Rosemary. It was perfectly timed.
Yeah.
Cuckoo clock.
What sound effect?
There was a cuckoo clock.
Your cuckoo clock in your background.
You probably don't even hear it anymore.
Yeah, it was not a personal thing,
I don't.
Rosemary. Yeah.
You know, Rosemary,
it's just that while you were talking, the cuckoo clock was going, you know. That was wrong. That was just wrong.
You're hitting on something that really does worry me. And in going back to the type of political violence that we saw in the 1960s, you know, the type of violence that saw the assassinations of Martin Luther King, of the Kennedys, this brings back huge concerns that I have for the well-being both of the democracy, but the people who are willing to serve in public positions. And what really bothers me is that it's getting not even to the sort of the leadership, it's getting into people like Fauci and civil service who are just simply trying to be competent and do their job. And you're right, this all stems from a man baby who, for whatever reason, can't accept a loss.
Well, some of the Republicans in the House who are being silent about this effort are the people who should know, who know most what this could lead to. I mean, some of them were at a softball game a few years ago that was, you know, shot up. They, mm-hmm. you know,
Steve Scalise, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we don't have to go back to the 60s to find examples of how you know, political rhetoric can lead to violence. I try to be the optimist on this show most of the time, but I am worried about the next few weeks. I will say that.
Chris Churchill on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, December 9th. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Roundtable producer Sarah LaDuc. On Thursday, December 10th, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue were joined by Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Ellerby, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Science at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler, and Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. I didn't meet the bear this morning.
Good. Excellent.
And I took my long walk, but in the dark, every minute thinking about the bear. But I've had some writers who have told me the bear is not out there. He's or she is in their den right now. I didn't know that.
Well, they'd be hibernating, right? Is that the deal?
It doesn't seem that cold, but what can I tell you? It wasn't cold this morning.
Well, no, it wasn't that cold, but I don't know how that's. I thought it was more seasonal, but I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Good stuff. All right. We also welcome to the proceedings Jim Hendler. He is Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. We have a lot to talk to you about, sir. All this Facebook stuff going on. We got to figure out what's going on here. You'll keep us straight on this. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. Good morning. How are you?
I'm great.
Well, good
day to be on the radio.
It is a good day to be on the radio. Isn't every day a good day to be on the radio? Linda Ellerby joins us, Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist, one of the first women to anchor the national news. Of course, known for her work on NBC, NBC Overnight, and then, of course, for years and years on Nick News. And we couldn't be more delighted to have her with us. Good morning, Linda Ellerby. How are you?
I am fine and dandy, Joe, and it's beautiful still here. The snow outside is all still snow at the moment.
Mm.
Go out there and look for bear tracks, will you please?
So, Alan, sometimes you meet the bears, and sometimes the bears meet you.
And if you leave off the M, you got to eat.
That's exactly what I was thinking. You know, there is that wonderful, wonderful joke that is in the movie The Imitation Game about two men hiking in the woods, and they come across a bear. One of them starts to lean down and tie his shoelaces. The other says, "What are you doing that for? You know you can't outrun a bear." And the man tying his shoelaces says, "I don't have to outrun the bear. I only have to outrun you."
And nice. See, you see, Alan, if there were more people out at 4 a.m, you wouldn't have that problem.
There's one guy walks by me every morning. He's got a light on his head, and he's got two dogs. And as I'm coming down the thing with my light on my head, he's on the other side. And those dogs sometimes, but not today, sometimes really yell at me. Yeah. That's not a pleasant experience.
No, the bears, the dogs. Goodness, yeah. Alan. You got a lot going on there. All right. So the big story is about Facebook. U.S. and states say that Facebook illegally crushed the competition. Regulators are accusing the company of buying up rising rivals to cement its dominance over social media. The Federal Trade Commission in more than 40 states out of the 50 accused Facebook on Wednesday of buying up its rivals. They called for the deals to be unwound, escalating regulators' battle against the biggest tech companies in a way that could remake the social media industry. Federal and state regulators of both parties who have investigated the company for over 18 months said in a separate, there were separate lawsuits that Facebook's purchases, especially Instagram for $1 billion in 2012 and WhatsApp for $19 billion 2 years ago, eliminated competition that could have one day challenged the company's dominance. Since those deals, Instagram and WhatsApp have skyrocketed in popularity, giving Facebook control over three of the world's most popular social media and messaging apps. The applications have helped catapult Facebook from a company started in a college dorm 16 years ago, just think of that, in only 16 years, to an internet powerhouse valued at more than $800 billion. Okay, Jim, let me begin with you on what this means. Explain this to us.
We heard from the New York State Attorney General, Letitia James, who led the multi-state investigation into Facebook, calling for the courts to stop the company from its anti-competitive behavior to protect small businesses. So do they have a case here?
This is a very interesting situation. First of all, the more liberal side of the political spectrum has long felt that big tech has too much power, is becoming monopolistic. Companies such as Google, Facebook, some of the others, Amazon, Microsoft, have been seen as really having too much power, controlling too much of our, the innovation economy in the U.S. There's a lot of different terms for this, but really they're a monopoly. And the monopolies have generally been protected by the more conservative side of our government, which has traditionally felt that government should not meddle in the economic policies of companies. So we should not have a commercial policy, and monopoly power should be, used very, very rarely. So what's changed is over the past few months, looking for a scapegoat in the election, the right wing has really started saying Google, Facebook, some of these other social media providers have been anti-right wing, right? And some of this has been because as white supremacy has gotten more dangerous, these sites have tried to clamp down on it. As lies have propagated and they're now working to fight misinformation, the people who tell more lies are, of course, more upset by what's going on. So you have this very interesting political alliance, which has formed with, at the moment, Facebook primarily and Google secondarily in the headlights. So that's kind of the political backstory. Then the technical backstory is both of these companies that Facebook acquired were given regulatory permission. So they were not, so Facebook is arguing back, how can you say now these were legal things? Meanwhile, Facebook right now is looking to acquire some new companies. So many people think that this is more to put a halt on some of that than to really get them broken up. This is the kind of lawsuit that's going to go on for years. Mm-hmm. And so you shouldn't expect any interesting immediate thing. But I think it's a warning shot fired across the bow of the tech companies. And there's a lot of other things in that space going on. We already talked a couple months ago about what was going on with TikTok.
Yeah.
Where, again, they used Chinese ownership as an excuse to try to break that up. And there's, some other things going on in that space too.
So let me ask two follow-up questions and we'll break out here for the rest of the group, of course. But one is, but it is important to note, and Facebook is saying this, but federal regulators, all of these acquisitions were cleared when they were done, right? So that's right. One thing. Isn't it hard then to come back and say, oh, yeah, you're trying to do this when they said, yeah, it's okay that you're trying to do this? And also of the states, which went up to 46 are complaining, it seems that if you get that much, there must be – what is the impact on the specific states that is concerning them so much?
So the specific impact on the states is that states control a lot of the trade, and states want small companies to be growing in their own states because that helps build their tax revenue and things like that. So when you have these huge companies in a few places, as opposed to a wide spread out of companies, that's bad for the states and localities where these things would be located, or in fact, where a lot of the workers live. So for example, Facebook New York has a very big presence, but they're not really seen as a New York company. So some of it is that the regulators are hoping that Facebook will voluntarily do some things. Some of it is because of the power Facebook has to control information is worrying people. If I, as a university, want to do some kind of studies about misinformation and disinformation, I have to go through a process called an institutional review board, which checks to make sure that against some federal rules, I'm not going to be hurting anybody, offending anybody, causing certain kinds of harm. Facebook and other big companies aren't under that same regulatory regime, so they don't have to do that. So there's a lot of things that have been done that have come out which have got people upset. So the argument is essentially that at the time that Facebook did these acquisitions, we were just looking at one acquisition at a time. So mm-hmm. the government can say, when we said it was fine to get one of these companies, we just looked at that impact at that moment. Now we see a history of this happening. We see Facebook getting ready to buy a company that actually probably very few people have heard of, called Customer with a K. But Customer is a company that manages lots and lots of how companies interact with their customers. Some of the things you get in the mail with the saying, you know, here are our sales today, things like that. Some of these point of contact information systems. And Facebook feels that with their information powering that, you could do much more. So really, in a sense, the argument is Facebook controls a lot of information about who we are, who we like, what we buy, things like that. And they can essentially sell access to this. So one of the things that, and we'd now be getting down a little bit more into the weeds. If you want to do geeking, we can get there. But Facebook has a way they could make that stuff more available. It's called the Open Graph. And they could make that available either for free or at a much lower cost or to all companies rather than just the companies they approve. So some people feel that's what the government wants to see, something that will let more companies form in more places using that information and not have them all feed this one big company in one place.
So maybe I can also add something, Joe and Jim, on an international level. The European Commission has also gone after Facebook, and that started a bit earlier, on two levels that are very similar to what Jim just described, namely antitrust issues and also how data is gathered and then monetized for advertising purposes. The European Commission has, or in Europe in general, there are much stricter rules in terms of what you collect and how you collect it about the information you collect about customers. And the European Commission has investigated now for at least a year and a half on this issue and challenged the kind of data collection and processing that has been monetized by Facebook through this combination of various platforms. And that inquiry is ongoing, and a lot of Europeans are paying very close attention because that is an even bigger market than here in the United States. So this is, in essence, pressure coming now from two different, entirely different regions and different kinds of economic blocks in that sense. And it's very serious, I think, in terms of an antitrust investigation into Facebook and such large corporations that maintain and manage detailed information and put bits together that weren't supposed to be collected and put together. And also it's in a sense, the argument is that they're killing off, either by purchasing potential competitors or by denying access to funding for potential competitors to rise within the marketplace that is so focused on Facebook.
Yes, that's right. So there's really two different issues going on here.
30 seconds. Go ahead.
The European issue is more around the privacy and control of information, and they've been after Google and now Facebook. U.S., we don't have those privacy regulations, so we go after them more on the monopoly side, but really the two are very tied together.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we continue and come back, we will check in with the other members of our panel. We will also move on to mail and other issues. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org. Simple as that. Write to us at panel@wamc.org.
WAMC.org, Alan Chartok, Jim Henwer, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Linda Ellerby make up the panel this morning. We'll be right back after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Thursday morning. Panel at WAMC.org to add your voice to the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan, anything you'd like to add to the conversation?
Well, as usual, yes. Joe, Facebook is extremely popular, I have to confess. I use it every once in a while. I live with a woman who I happen to be married to who is pretty user-friendly with the, with Facebook. A lot of people love Facebook, and I think that that's going to be the problem. So I'm always looking for political motives in why people are doing things. In the case of our attorney general in New York State, she is obviously the lead attorney on this and has a lot of other people following her. I have a feeling that she's going to be popular among some for going after what is a clear monopoly and unpopular with all those people who are saying, leave my Facebook alone. Why are you dealing with this monopoly as opposed to so many others? And I would like to just inject that into the conversation.
Yeah, that's a great point about the other monopolies, because they're certainly, I mean, they're not hard to find. Right, Jim?
You know, the technical definition of a monopoly is very complicated, Joe, and our country has long had this sort of love-hate relationship with some of these things. But as Alan says, the political dimension, you know, is where a lot of this comes from. And, you know, it's very interesting. So, you know, just another related story that's on, you know, the Defense Authorization Bill, which is a 3,240-page piece of legislation, has been threatened to be vetoed by the president because it doesn't contain a repeal of something called CDA Section 230. Now, if that sounds like an obscure little thing, CDA Section 230 is what lets all these companies be free from libel suits and slander suits and from being accused of misinformation and things like that. So again, it's an attack by this government on specifically Facebook and Google, and it would also impact a lot of other companies. So we see several different things going on at the same time. And it's, again, it's this combination of scapegoating these companies because of the election and a real political concern about the power of these monopolies, because these companies have gotten so big, they control a major section of our country's economy. So it's a very interesting dynamic that's playing out at the moment.
Jim Henler on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, December 10th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable or available on the WAMC app. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
Crazy, nuts, meshuggah,